Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Eunice and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Eunice. Thanks for joining us.
Today we're diving back into A Gypsy's Kiss, A Treasure Hunt Adventure. And we're pretty excited because our friend Miguel has made it to New Orleans today. And we get to travel right into New Orleans with him. That's pretty exciting, isn't it?
I feel like it was, yeah. Is now, and was then.
So for those of you who have not been following along, we're following along with 15-year-old Miguel Eunice, which is Toby, when he was 15, back in 1964. He's on a trip across from New Mexico, across Texas and Louisiana into New Orleans to attend Mardi Gras. He's had quite the adventure, and he's finally arriving just in time to partake of the festivities, and we're going to get into that today. You ready to get into that today?
Yeah.
Big party time. The name of the chapter is New Orleans, chapter 24. Ranger Bolton gave me a Louisiana roadmap to follow, and I travel fast and easy until it gets dark. I stop briefly for gas and oil and finish the food Kate provided. The oatmeal cookies are soft and delicious, with crunchy walnuts and plump raisins. They remind me of home and give me the energy I need to keep going. The amount of traffic on the roads increases progressively the nearer I get to the city, and there is a point at which, over a hill, and between the dense green foliage on either side of the road, I can see the glow in the sky from the lights of the city below. I have arrived. I cross the bridge over the Mississippi. More traffic, lights, noise, and celebrating people are everywhere. I ride south toward Bourbon Street because I've read that's where most of the action will be. The traffic in the streets makes for slow riding, but I use the maneuverable motorcycle to get around a lot of it, eventually arriving at the barriers that separate the vehicular traffic from the crowds. I see a local police officer, so I stop and call out, "Where should I park?" He points down the street ahead of me and shouts, "Police impound." The traffic on the road is at a complete standstill, but the street is wide enough for me to slowly walk astride the motorcycle up the right side and inside the vehicles. A short way up the street, there is a right turn into an alley that is too narrow for the cars and trucks, but wide enough for me in the BSA, so I take that route. It is dark and smells like urine, but it brings me all the way to the lights, life, sounds, and fun of Bourbon Street. Not knowing exactly how to proceed, and with the bike running, I take a moment to figure out what to do. Before I can decide upon anything, another police officer points a nightstick at me and yells, "Turn that thing off, jackass!" Not looking for a confrontation, I yell back in his direction, "Impound lot!" He points to my left, up the street, using his shiny hickory nightstick. I flick the transmission into neutral, hit the kill switch, and still astride the bike, walk it around to the left, and toward the impound lot. It is very slow going. The street is crowded with people, walking in waves of motion, in opposite directions, and bouncing off each other like steel balls in a pinball machine. Many scantily clad women are wearing layers upon layers of colorful beaded necklaces. Purple and gold decorations and twinkling lights adorn the buildings and street lamps. Partiers standing on the balconies overhead are tossing beads to the partygoers on the street below. Thinking it would make a cool souvenir, I reach up to grab a strand of beads as it flies through the air. Got it. I shove the long, slippery strand in my pocket and keep moving forward, my head swiveling constantly so I can see and remember everything about my Mardi Gras experience. Meanwhile, without my knowing it, several more of the necklaces thrown from the balconies get caught up in the drive chain and spokes of the bike's rear wheel. I can't see them, and because of the music and crowd noise, I can't hear all the crunching sounds going on behind me. As I lift one of my feet to move forward, the bike locks up as if I had slammed on the brakes, catching me by surprise, and I fall over. Instinctively, I check myself and my surroundings. My head has landed right in the middle of the foot traffic, so my first reaction is to protect my head. But as they notice me on the ground, people skirt around me in my mini accident. For the first time on this entire trip, there seems to be no one to help me. I start to scramble out from under the bike, but before I can, the shadows of four very attractive women cause me to look up. They are all dressed in beautiful, bright outfits, their hair perfectly coiffed, their long nails painted red, and their feet in what my mother calls summer sandals, with a couple of inches of heel on them. I can't tell whether they are talking to me, at me, or about me, and I can't understand any of what they're saying, but it is obvious to me that watching me trying to squirm out from under my bike is funny to them. One of them leans over, one hand on her knee, the other filled with the leather handles of a large purse, and says in French-accented English, "Do you need a little help?" Wondering how this petite young woman can possibly help lift the motorcycle up off me, I nonetheless answer, "I sure do." She stands up straight, turns around, and in French says something to the crowd behind her that finishes with the recognizable phrase, "S'il vous plaît." In just a moment, a pair of burly men help lift the bike off me. They hold it long enough for me to brush myself off, clear the mechanicals of beaded necklaces, and mount up again. While this is all happening, the women continue to chat with each other in what almost sounds like French, but as I discover later, is the Louisiana Cajun or Acadian dialect. Three of the women are older, late 20s, early 30s. One seems to be like me, a teenager, but a little older, 17, maybe 18. "Thank you very much for your help," I say. "No problem," she responds. "It is better for you to take your motorcycle to the end of the street. My friends will help you." She and her friends follow behind, collecting more beaded necklaces as we proceed down the street. The lot is identified by a big yellow sign with black letters. "New Orleans Police Impound Lot," it reads. Then it is repeated in French. There are two police officers standing at the opening. One of them, the bigger of the two, asks, "You want to leave your bike, kid?" I answer, "Yes, I do." "You got some kind of lock for that?" "Yes." He points toward the back of the lot, filled with all kinds of bicycles, scooters, and motorcycles, and tells me, "There's some space toward the back. Push it back there. Find a space and make sure you lock it up. Pick it up before 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Otherwise, it becomes the property of the city of New Orleans." He writes something on what looks like a ticket, rips it in half, hands me one piece, and ties the other to the BSA's handlebars. "Don't lose that. You'll need it to get your bike back," he tells me. Part of me wants to ask if he is serious, but since I have no reason to leave the bike there until 6 tomorrow morning, I decide not to ask and push the bike into a space at the back of the lot. I stuff my cap, goggles, gloves, my papers, and some money into my satchel and sling it over my shoulder and chain the bike to a thick metal pole. Leaving the impound lot, I can see that the four women are standing there as if they are waiting for me. Then, the youngest one speaks to the others, and the older three walk away, waving and smiling as they do. The one that remains is beautiful and very petite, with a sweet smile and eyes that sparkle from the lights all around. We exchange a handshake, and she introduces herself. Mariah, bonjour. I'm not sure I correctly heard what she said, so I ask, Maria? No, she slowly corrects me. Mariah. Pleasure to meet you, Mariah. I point to myself. Miguel. Miguel, you are Spanish? No, I'm from New Mexico. We speak Spanish as a second language, like you speak French here. She giggles at me. I speak French first, and then English. For the next couple of hours, we navigate our way up and down Bourbon Street, through the crowds, the lights, and the noise, exchanging questions and answers, learning about one another. She is surprised to learn that I rode the motorcycle all the way from Abiquiu, New Mexico, to New Orleans just to see Mardi Gras, and she asks why. I tell her that the Christian brothers at my school always spoke of it, and I wanted to see what it was like. The mention of the Christian brothers stops her. She turns toward me and asks, Christian brothers? Your teachers are Christian brothers? Yes, I answer. Christian brothers at St. Michael's High School in Santa Fe, New Mexico. My teachers, too, were Christian brothers at St. George's School in Metairie, Louisiana. I've heard of Metairie. My Christian brothers come from there. Again, she laughs, as do mine. I smile, delighting in her laughter. So we have the Christian brothers in common. We walk and talk some more, and the time for me goes by quickly. But as the night draws on, Mariah turns to announce, I think it is time for me to go. Go, I ask. Go where? To where I stay in Algiers, across the river. I know there is an Algiers across the river, and I know it is a French-Cajun community. I also heard it is rough around the edges. However, I've come to the conclusion that Mardi Gras is not going to be any fun without Mariah, and the fates have brought me here specifically to be with her. Seeing my face reflect my disappointment and longing, Mariah asks, Would you like to come with me? It is late, just past midnight. I worry about what might happen to the BSA. Reading my mind, Mariah assures me, Your motorcycle will be fine. I'll bring you back before it turns into the pumpkin. I chuckle at her insight, and she smiles and giggles too. The apparent uncertainty in my eyes causes her to take both my hands in hers, lean forward and give me a gentle kiss on the lips, barely touching them. At this point, I will follow her anywhere. All right. So we figured out why you went to Mardi Gras. Maybe you figured it out too.
It was, you know, our lives are always motivated by the expectation of the next event that takes place in our lives. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the expectation is achieved and sometimes it's not. Mm-hmm. And so you plan on the next big event that's going to take place in your life. And it doesn't have to be big in this, in the carnival sense. It doesn't even have to be big in the getting married or the having babies sense. It's just big in how you see life. And I feel like this was one of those.
Yeah. Well, I think when we're teenagers, meeting someone that we're, you know, we feel an attraction to uh-huh. is a big deal. It's a very big deal.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, it was funny. The connection, the almost immediate connection, was strange to me. Mm-hmm. It always seemed to me like getting a girlfriend always took time, you know.
Yeah.
And developing the relationship. This was one of those that was just very natural. This was probably a Libra. I don't know for certain. But... So.
Well, some of the themes and emotions in Chapter 24 of New Orleans are adventure and exploration. Community and helpfulness. We saw Mariah and her friends help him out when he fell off the motorcycle, or he fell over. He didn't fall all the way off. Unexpected encounters and connections. Of course, Miguel meeting Mariah. Disappointment and resilience. He was disappointed when the evening was coming to a close. That he was like, suddenly, wait a minute. This is why I'm here. This is the whole fun of being here, is being with someone and experiencing it with somebody. But then, you know, when she invited him, it changed him. You know, it's just like, oh, we can continue to have more fun. Yes.
So the way that I saw it is that at that moment, when I thought it was all going to be over, I thought I had a pretty good story to tell when I got back home at that point.
Yeah.
And of course, the fact that we moved forward created an even better, I suppose it depends on who defines better, but
bigger, better, longer story.
Yeah. But at this point, I felt like, again, you've set this goal for yourself. You've arrived in New Orleans. You're pushing yourself down Bourbon Street. And then you have this secondary adventure with someone who is as intriguing as you've always believed it was potential to be, meet someone like that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what made it a good story at that point. And you know, you've heard me tell the story 100 times, I suppose. It's still one of those points in my life that I recall not only with a fondness, but with an appreciation of what a great story it was. And how it could last, how it could end, how it was a good enough story, it could end up in a book, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. And we continue on with youthfulness and freedom. You had the freedom to go on this journey, to experience Mardi Gras, to meet somebody, to get to, you know, just spontaneously hang out with her for the evening. You know, this was all very freeing. You know, didn't have anybody. You had to ask permission of, can I do this? Is this okay? Just yes, saying yes to life, living in the moment. And also the cultural experience and the celebration and, you know, just diving right into something that was very much a cultural expression of, what New Orleans is all about.
Well, and at that point in time, in the 60s, Mardi Gras was a very, it was like the Santa Fe Fiesta one in the 60s. It was very, it was compact to the people that lived in the area, sometimes the people that lived in New Mexico. It wasn't, in the case of the Santa Fe Fiesta, in the case of Mardi Gras, it was the same way. It was a local thing, not as much. And then, of course, as it grew, I mean, I have daughters who attended with friends when they were in college, but it was all the college kids going. So like everything else, as it expanded for business, and it's good, what happened in terms of the Santa Fe Fiesta, for example, and probably in terms of Mardi Gras, although I couldn't say for certain, is as more and more people were attracted from outside the area, the people that were from the area were, I don't want to say they were pushed out, but they lost that interest that used to attract them to it. So they were replaced, their energy, that local energy was replaced by, you know, national and international arrivals just to be at Mardi Gras for the experience. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, it was a kind of a French version, although a little bit more liquor induced experience or celebration, in the same way that Fiesta was a celebration that was very important to the locals, but not necessarily important to anybody else. And so I had that to compare to. I used to love going downtown to Fiesta, you know, from the Friday when it opened on Friday night. And then I think Saturday was all about Sosobra. And then Sunday was all about mass and processions and the arrival of the conquistadores. And, you know, and I always had family members in that. But that's what it was all about. And suddenly it was the Santa Fe Fiesta. We're going to burn some stuff up and party for a week, you know, well, a long weekend. And that's, I think that's what happened to Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. It became I suppose the correct word to use is commercialized.
Yeah.
And because it became commercialized, it attracted a lot of other people, but it grew New Orleans, that downtown area, you know, where you had, I don't know, I want to say 5 or 10 small hotels that were made in the architecture of Bourbon Street, you know, brick, 18th century brick. Suddenly there's a Marriott, and then there's a Hilton, and then there's a taller Marriott, you know. And so it kind of changed the energy from a local one with a reason for being there, because after all, it started out as a real form of religious celebration. It is mm-hmm. Fat Tuesday, the day before Ash Wednesday, which is the beginning of the Lenten season. And it was always in the context of, I don't care how drunk we get tonight, we're going to be a church tomorrow.
So, how did this feel as I've made it? I'm here. This is the culmination of this entire journey. And it just, because, you know, like when we set a goal and we feel like this is going to be wonderful when I get there, a lot of times we get there and it's not everything that we thought it would be. You know, we get there and it's like, okay, I still have all the same problems that I had before. Life is not any different. I'm not any different. You know, reaching my goal didn't change anything. So how did it feel getting to this goal?
I think there were two big things about it. Number one, aside from just achieving the objective, mm-hmm. In addition to that, there were two things. Number one, I matured a lot in those few days. Mm-hmm. And that was from the result of the experiences that I was having. And the second thing that happened is I feel like I grew or I evolved socially. Again, because of the interactions that I was having with people, there was a certain amount of maturity that comes from being on the road. I mean, you have no sense of that it's dangerous at all. But it is. You're a 15-year-old. You're riding a motorcycle, which in and of itself it has risks associated with it. You're riding with a helmet without a helmet, which, again, has risks associated with it. But you don't think of those. You just think about how much you're enjoying this. I mean, I don't know that I could do that long a ride at this age, not just because I'm old, without having to stop, you know, ride 4 hours, stop for the night in a hotel, have a nice dinner, take a shower, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Roughing it the way that it was perfect for a person that age who was maturing along the way. And I think the fact that I was maturing and then I was socially evolving were all kind of good things that happened as a result. That is without giving continence to the fact that that was a very risky thing to do mm-hmm. in a lot of different ways. But it didn't strike me. To this day, you know, I've never thought of it as, wow, that was a really risky thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always remembered it in a very positive and warming way mm-hmm. Because of, again, the maturity factor and the socialization factor.
Well, it's like when my husband and I went on our honeymoon, mm-hmm. We were spending every dime that we have to go on this trip to Hawaii. And in fact, we had to borrow money from his parents to get back. so we did. We spent everything in our bank accounts to get to go on this honeymoon. And you know, we didn't ever think back on that as that was crazy to do mm-hmm. that. And it was, but we didn't regret it for a minute. Right. You know, we had a good time. We got to see Hawaii. It was beautiful. We got to spend time together. We enjoyed our time together there. And we don't regret doing it. And you didn't regret doing it. But, you know, as we get older, it's funny because it's like, you see movies about people going on a vacation and all the things that go wrong, and, you know, and they just, it never lives up to the hype that you think it should. You know, it should be this wonderful vacation. Because when we were older, when we were like 29, 30 years old, just before we were getting ready to have kids, we thought we'll go on one more vacation before we have kids. We went to Cabo San Lucas in Mexico, and we had this all-inclusive vacation down there, and we, you know, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. And then it was just like all these things that went wrong, you know, that we went with this other couple, and it rained really hard the first night we were there, and their room flooded, and oh, it was just like, and then it was super hot and humid, and then the meals that were included were, the food was not very good. I mean, they had like this weird chicken dish where the chicken bones were in with it, and it was like, what is this? You know, it was very strange and weird, and we're just like, you know, very judgy of the whole thing. So I don't know if it's because we got older and we had traveled quite a bit by then, so we had higher expectations. So, you know, maybe we were, when we were younger, like when you had this trip, you weren't expecting anything because you hadn't done this before. It was all brand new to you. So you accepted anything that came your way and thought, this is great. Just like when we went to Hawaii and we didn't have any expectations, and we were just like, this is great. And it was our first time flying first class. This is amazing, you know, and we spent all the money we had, and we're like, that's okay. We'll make more money. You know, we're starting out, we're doing fine. And, but by the time we were 30, we're like, you know, this is weird. What's wrong here? You know, and we traveled more by then. We had higher expectations. So I guess there's that, you know, we get a little more jaded as we get older.
I think it's the jaded, and the other part of it, of course, is that I've traveled most of my life.
Yeah.
And I've learned that things can, you know, I had a conversation with someone in the last time I was traveling, and he said he was worried about his luggage. And I said, even if you lose it, they'll find it for you. You know, it's rare that it gets completely lost. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, did you ever have that experience? I said, I think in my entire travel life, they've lost my luggage once. And so I think if you expect bad things to happen, there's a tendency to do. When I was traveling, when we were traveling with the children, no matter where we went, and that included trips to the Caribbean, to all across America, into Canada, et cetera, et cetera. I discovered that my job as the dad was to make sure that anything did go wrong wasn't going to affect them. Like, they didn't even have to know it was going wrong, because if it goes wrong for your dad or the mom, and the, I'm not going to be critical of anyone, but it was always easier for me to take the recognition that something has gone wrong here. You guys go sit down over there. I'm going to take care of this so we can fix it or whatever it is. And it, you know, you learn that if you invest a little time and you're not screaming and yelling, and you do it with in a gentlemanly way, you'll usually get it. They'll help you get it fixed. They don't want it to go wrong either. So that experience, between the experience of my travels all over the world, including, you know, hot zones, and the travel with the children, made me a really good, very patient traveler. And one who doesn't get upset if it rains and my room floods. I just go downstairs and say, I need a new room, you know. My room is flooded. Or not that that's ever happened. but then there are places, when you're in places like Afghanistan and you have a room, you've got the, you know, you've got the best room that they can offer, not because you're any special, you're special, but that's the state of the rooms, you know, the food is the state of the food. And when you're traveling like that and you meet other, you're with other people that are in the same experience, what you learn is stay at this hotel, eat at this restaurant, or if you like this food, go to this restaurant, stay out of that location after 8 o'clock at night, you know, kind of thing. So, but I wanted to say something else about something that you mentioned early on, about the, before you actually started reading, and you mentioned something about the experience of freedom, or experiencing as freedom, because up until that time, Miguel really didn't have much freedom. He was, you know, managed and controlled by his family and by the Christian Brothers and his situation, etc. When it came, what you discover when these things happen is freedom is however you define it. Freedom is what you believe it to be. And you can have your mother guiding you and the Christian Brothers corralling you in their good and gentle way, and you can still be free. Because I think what you discover is that freedom is a state of mind, and it can either be your state of mind or a state of mind that's influenced by external factors. A good example, I mean, we can think of dozens of examples, but the best and most memorable example for me is 1984, the book, where the people in the book, in their various situations, all are convinced that they are free. And you're looking at the book, and if you watch the movie, the one with Richard Burton is really well done. They did a really good job of implementing Huxley's book. But freedom is, and there's probably songs written this way, freedom is the art of being believing that you're free and behaving like you're free without impacting or infringing on the freedom of others. And I think that was what happened in this experience, the recognition that freedom is however I define it. And as long as I'm not infringing on someone else's freedoms, my freedom is how I define it. And I think that was the other element when you mentioned it, you know, the experience of having the freedom or becoming more free to do these things. It was a mental thing. It happened inside my head, like, oh, so this is the definition of freedom, me making my choices. And as long as in the same way the Constitution guarantees us all our rights, as long as we're not infringing on someone else's rights, freedom is the same way. Freedom is, you define it, as long as you're not infringing on someone else's rights. You know, you have a right to enjoy your life without impacting anyone else's. So I think that's what happened on this. That's where the freedom and independence came from.
Yeah. And I know that freedom is a state of mind, but I feel like this story describes freedom in that Miguel is like, I get to do exactly what I want and nobody's going to say no. Uh-huh. Even to the point where he spent the entire evening with Mariah and then she said, well, I've got to go now. And he looked disappointed. Uh-huh. And she said, do you want to go with me? You know, and then he could say, yes, uh-huh. You know, I do want to go with you. And
his choice. Right?
Yeah.
He didn't.
But he, you know, she didn't say, you can't go with me and the night is over. Uh-huh. She gave him that additional option to choose more, to choose to have more time with her. So he was never curtailed. He was given more and more freedom. I don't know. It's almost like, kind of reminds me of the Pinocchio story where he's like goes to the carnival, you know, and he's just given more and more. And, you know, he continues to be led astray, but mm-hmm. but he gets to say yes to everything he wants, you know.
As this story, as we continue through it, it's you have to ask yourself, maybe it would have been better if you had said,
it does kind of go towards the Pinocchio route.
Yeah. Have a good evening, thank you very much for your help. I'm gonna go get my motorcycle and find a place to sleep.
Yeah.
Would have been the sensible thing to right. do.
Well, perhaps. So. But when we're attracted to somebody and they ask us to do something, we're more likely to say, yes, of course I will. I will follow you anywhere. After she kissed him. He was definitely living in the moment and enjoying the cultural richness and celebration of being in Mardi Gras and celebrating the fact that he made it. He went on that long journey. He achieved his goal. He got there before the party was over. He got to enjoy the entire party.
I moved the table into our screens here. Let me just adjust it.
He he achieved that goal. It was exciting for him, mm-hmm. and he got to celebrate that goal. And I think sometimes we forget to do that ourselves. You know, we actually achieve the goal that we set out to achieve, and we don't take the time to celebrate. And I think this is a really good moment in the book because of that. It reminds us that, you know, yay, he made it. Now let's take this chapter and celebrate that he's there, mm-hmm. and that he made that journey and that he achieved his goal, and he's there at the party and he's having a good time. And, you know, yeah, he falls over on his motorcycle, but he meets a girl. It's a cute meet, mm-hmm. but it really did happen that way too. So, you know, but that we get to, and, you know, smell the roses. We get to enjoy the moment. Sometimes we forget to do that.
And early, you know, we've talked about this or towards the beginning of the book, where he perceived himself as to be a loner. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm alone and all, I'm fighting off the battles from all these evils around me, when none of them were that evil, you know, weren't evil at all. But here, because of the social component, he finds someone to partner in the celebration. Like, oh, well, why not? You know, they're not drinking age. Nobody's going to serve them if they were to walk into a bar. They didn't think about eating. They found places. There were places all, I mean, you could live on beignet, you know. So there was, it was that kind of situation where you were kind of snacking along the way. You couldn't drink alcohol. You know, a soda was as close as you could get to drinking anything, but you didn't think about it because you were with this fascinating individual, like no one you've ever met, very different from anyone that you've ever met, with this cute little accent, you know. And so why not call that the celebration, you know, and enjoy it as much as you possibly can. That was the other thing too, is for, in his opinion, this may be the last great adventure, because the only thing he sees is going back to Santa Fe, going back to St. Michael's, and being yelled at by the combination of Brother Benjamin and his mother. So, like, this was a big thing for him. I mean, I don't think he realized that it was the beginning of his life as opposed to the end of it. But that, at that point, it was like, okay, I better really enjoy this, because this will never happen again. You know? So it was good. It was good to have that experience. It was good to have the experience of having been there at a time where it was still that kind of celebration and a real pleasure. And of course, as we know, as we go into the book, it takes a turn for the worse. Yeah. But, you know, nothing that, who dives into the Mississippi River and expects to live, you know, like.
Now we're giving stuff away.
Okay, let's not give away.
But let's talk about enjoying the moment. Every moment along the path of our lives is an opportunity to enjoy. It's like, you know, I can look at the day and say, ugh, you know, all the bad things that happened, you know, why did that happen? And why did this happen? Or I can look at the good things and say, what? A check came in the mail today that I wasn't expecting. And that's great. And, you know, and I went for a nice walk today and it was beautiful weather. And, you know, and people said hello to me on my walk and it was peaceful and it was beautiful. And, you know, just pull out the beautiful things and just look at them and enjoy them and breathe them in and just incorporate that into your attitude, I guess, and celebrate that rather than just letting it, you know, swoosh on by. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I really like about this chapter the most, is it's a celebration of everything that's come before, mm-hmm. and it's a pause before diving into what's coming after.
The difference, the biggest difference between that 15-year-old Miguel and the 75-year-old Toby is that now you know, for having made it this far, now you know that if you don't celebrate every second, right, of existence, you're wasting your time, because you're just not going to be here forever. Time is coming to an end, and your time is coming to an end. It may be tomorrow, it may be 20 years from now, but you're in the latter half of your life, you know. And so the idea is that there are good things that are going to happen. There are bad things that are going to happen. And if you can get through the bad things, you know, what's anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger, whatever it is. You have to really appreciate that saying, because there are going to be things in your life that will cause pain and distress. And you've just got to get through them, because most of your life isn't that way. You know, losing a sibling, losing a father, losing a mother, losing someone that you love, losing a partner. All of those are moments in time that you can look back on and pay it its the respect that it deserves. But your life's not made up of those bad things. It's made up of good things that you can celebrate and enjoy, take advantage of, because you realize there just isn't enough of them left. You know, you better take advantage of the ones that you do get. So it doesn't, I can't say that my life is, you know, 24 hours of perfect happiness every day. There are always things that come into it. There are things from, you know, mashing your thumb with a hammer to mosquitoes biting you when you didn't even think you had mosquitoes biting in the backyard, you know, like, so you can look at that and you say, that's angry. And I'm just going to have to slab some of that clear stuff on it so it doesn't itch, you know, and then go over it and then find something happier to do.
Well, it reminds me of, like, I just told that story about the honeymoon. Well, that's one of the stories that I talked about when I put together the what you might call the eulogy or the culmination story that I put together for Kevin at his memorial. And putting together a story about somebody's life like that, you look for good stories that bring up happy memories and things that will cause people to smile and laugh and, you know, think of their own good stories. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't focus on anything negative or, you know, we had a bad day and we talk, you know, you don't bring that up because it's not important. Mm-hmm. What is important is that, you know, overall, good person, love to learn, love to laugh, love to make other people laugh, enjoyed life, you know, and those are the things that we want to celebrate. And when we come together to celebrate somebody's life, or we come to celebrate that, you know, you reached your goal, or you're having a birthday, you know, a big birthday, big 60th birthday coming up. That's a time to pause and reflect on all the good things that you have in your life to celebrate and enjoy.
That little thing that you said, I don't even know, it's been years that you said it, where we were talking about something, and you said tragedy plus time equals comedy. And that has always stuck with me, because as I've aged and I look back in all these situations, I can always find the joy in them. Not that I'm happy that my father died when I was 11, but I can look back and when my Aunt Lucy stepped on the parakeet. And it was funny because she didn't just lift her foot. She wasn't sure that, like, did you see that? You know, did you happen to notice that I actually stepped on the parakeet and the little feathers were sticking out from his shoe, things like that. And all you heard was, and now it's funny.
Now it's funny.
My brother and my sister cried. The two brothers and sister cried their eyes out. And they weren't crying. They weren't crying because they had just been informed their father passed away. Right? They were caring because Lucy stepped on the bird. But you could make a whole comedy routine out of that, you know. And that's brought a lot of joy into my life, this age, because I can look back on things that I've experienced in my life and I can find the humor in them. And I think if you look at it in that way, they aren't half as bad as they were in the moment that they occurred. So I look for humor in those things now. much to the chagrin of family members.
All right. Well, I hope that this moment of pause and celebration has been a time to that reminded you to pause and celebrate something that you've achieved, and that you can celebrate along with Miguel in his achieving his goal of getting to Mardi Gras. We'll be back again next week to continue his adventure during the Mardi Gras celebration. He's still in the middle of it, and there's more to come. And we hope that you will come back and get the rest of the story with us next week. And anything else you want to add?
So, yes. Okay. It didn't take us long to write this book. We wrote the majority of it while we were traveling to and from New Orleans. For background, for the treasure hunt. But if you get a chance, start writing down the elements of your life story. Look back on those days where it all started, where you started becoming the person that you are today. Start writing them down. And one day you'll find that you can leave that to the people around you that love you the most, and they'll really appreciate that.
Mm. Yep. That's all we have for today. See you again next time. Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story, because your story matters.